Good morning.
It is always good to be with you and great to be with you today. Just a quick update here before I do get into the word this morning regarding my work, since you are so faithful in supporting us in that, and I thank you for that. The work is going well. The summer months, as you can imagine, are slow because most of my work is on campuses, high school or college campuses, or even banquets and conferences, workshops, even churches. Almost nobody has us in the summer, so the summer months are slow. So I'm grateful for the fall here and the schedule picking up. I have several opportunities. If you're ever interested, you can go to our website and see where I'll be speaking. Dr. Christina Francis also is getting a lot of opportunities. I saw that on the website here recently. So we share on the same ministry team at Life Training Institute. If you don't know that, I assume everybody knows that, right? So a lot of things coming up here in the fall and into the winter months that I'm real excited about. Some larger colleges. When I say larger, they're small, but for Christian colleges, some larger colleges that I'll be speaking at. I'm excited about that. So a lot of good things going on there. And so thank you once again. I'm just grateful for this church and for the commitment that you have to life and the support that you have given to us. We don't take that for granted. I want you to know that. And if you're not receiving my monthly newsletter, I know recently Wendell made a sign up available to you, and by now you should have all at least received the last month's if you signed up. But if you didn't sign up, write it down on a piece of paper, your email address that is, and hand it to me afterwards, and I'll be sure that you're getting my monthly newsletter, because I'd love for you to do that. I thought of this on the way here, and I'm going to run the risk of sounding extremely prideful, which I am, but I was thinking, no matter how bad this sermon is this morning, this is a great day for you as a church, and for me, because you get a break from Wendell, and I get another break from Pastor Sean, so everybody wins. And I understand Pastor Sean, was it last Sunday he was here? Yeah, so anyways. Anyway, you all laugh, but you all do appreciate the break, let's be honest about it. Yeah. Touche. J. Gresham Machen, a name that I'm sure is not unfamiliar to this church, the Presbyterian theologian and professor at Princeton Seminary from 1906 to 1929, stood strong and largely alone against the infiltration of modernist or liberal theology, which eventually destroyed Princeton University, as you know. And he wrote this in a great little book, by Stephen Nichols, titled J. Gresham Machen. He wrote this. He said, "This world's problems," and we've got a screen here. You guys are high tech. All right, there it is. There's the quote. He said, "This world's problems can never be solved by those who make this world the object of their desires. This world cannot be bettered if you think that this world is all there is. To move the world, you must have a place to stand." I love that quote. To move the world, you must have a place to stand. This morning, I want to study a man who had a place to stand and who did better the world as a result of that, and that man is Daniel. But it is not his bettering the world that I want to focus on, although he did do that. Instead, I want to focus on his faithfulness in the face of severe pressure and testing under persecution. I want to consider the godly resolve of one of the men that the writer of Hebrews undoubtedly had in mind when he wrote of those who, quote, through faith shut the mouths of lions. I want to look at the story of Daniel and the lion's den. If you want to turn to Daniel chapter 6, if you brought your Bible, if not, I did put the words on, they'll be on the screen behind me as we go through it. Just a few comments here, some background here for you. Of course, this chapter, I know it's very familiar, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you here this morning, this records the assault on Daniel's religious freedom and his response to it. He found himself in a morally corrupt culture that was hell-bent on pressing him into its mold through the imposition of godless laws that were intended to deny him of that freedom, his religious freedom, that is. The relevancy, of course, for us is obvious. This is not unlike the culture that we find ourselves in today. It's not to say it's the same. It certainly isn't. But we're seeing similarities there. Daniel is an old man now. Into his 70s, some believe even into his 80s by the time that this story takes place. He's serving a new master in Babylon. He was serving King Nebuchadnezzar. Now he's serving King Darius. Same city, same landscape, but the king has changed, the culture has changed, and respect for the law has changed. The thread that runs through the first half of the book, through these first six chapters anyway, is that of godly character, specifically Daniel's godly character, which puts him in the crosshairs of evil men. And I don't need to say this, but I'm going to say it, so maybe I feel like I do need to say it, but I'll say it. This is not a fable, because I know how my mind works. You come across stories like Noah and the Ark, or Daniel in the Lion's Den, or David and Goliath, and they have sort of a childish kind of a ring to them. You know, we've heard those stories, well, at least many of us have heard those stories since we were children, and they sort of take on sort of a, you know, Adventures in Odyssey kind of a feel to them. You know, they're not real, they're fun, they're entertaining. This is a true historical account of a real man who lived in a real place, who faced off with evil men and ended up in a real den of lions. And so I hope I don't insult you with that comment, but just to sort of jar you out of that fantasy world, and let's look at, we're really looking at our church history here. We're looking at our family tree. And I'm real excited that this guy's in our family tree. I'm proud of him. I've got a few family members I'm not so proud of. I won't mention them by name this morning, but Daniel I'm proud of. So what I want to do is I want to look through, it's a long chapter, and we're going to look through all of it, but we're not going to get tedious here with it. What I want to do is read through it, and as we read, after a paragraph or so, or a verse or so, I'm going to stop, make some comments. And then at the end, I want to share two lessons, I want to draw two lessons from this chapter that I think will be of value to all of us. So let's go ahead and start in verse 1. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps, or princes, to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So look again there at verse 3. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Daniel's character, which has elevated him to one of the highest offices in the land, is well known, even by his enemies, as we will see here, and it's well documented for us. If you go back to chapter 1 in this book, verse 8, we read that Daniel resolved there not to defile himself with the royal food and wine that was offered to him, that was really even pushed on him to some extent. And so we see in chapter 2 that he's waiting to be executed along with the other wise men because of their inability to interpret King Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. And as they're basically on death row there, he speaks to Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, and we read there that he does so with wisdom and tact. And in verse 17 of chapter 2, Daniel encourages the others, these other wise men that are also awaiting execution, to plead for mercy from the God of heaven. And so, not to make too much of this, but Daniel's a leader. He's a man of wisdom. He's a man of humility. In that same chapter, in chapter 2, verses 27 and 28, when he's now before King Nebuchadnezzar, he displays great faith and great humility. He says, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." And so we see this humility in Daniel, we see this confidence in Daniel, and there's so much about him, and we see some of that even here in this chapter. Again, even his enemies found him blameless. Verse 5 again, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." This is a remarkable testimony from his enemies, given the fact that it doesn't take very long to find some weakness of which to exploit in almost any man or woman. His sterling character and his political promotion provide the occasion for great envy, so much so that his enemies are not content to ruin him politically. They want him killed. That's the goal here, is to kill Daniel, to destroy him. And I think of this verse in Proverbs 27, verse 4, that says, "Anger is cruel and fury overwhelming, but who can stand before jealousy?" That's the position that Daniel finds himself in. He's so blameless with regard to the law that they realize that the only way they're going to trip him up, the only way they're going to catch him, is to create or establish an unjust law, one that they know he will disobey. So even this is a testimony to his faithfulness and a credit to his character. In addition, Daniel's light was not hidden under a bushel. He was well known for his love for God, for his faithfulness to God. He was characterized by a quiet, humble faith, but not a reclusive, hidden faith. Again, even his enemies knew what his life was like. They knew what his commitment to Christ was like. Or I say commitment to Christ, his commitment to God. Look at verses 6 and following, 6 through, what is it, 8. So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Now, of course, this is a blatant lie here that all of the satraps and advisors have agreed. Daniel certainly didn't agree to this. So this is a blatant lie. They're using flattery here to appeal to Darius' ego, which, of course, works splendidly. They're introducing a law to him that would supposedly honor him as the king. In fact, more than that, would worship him as the king, but in reality would only set him against one of his favorites, namely Daniel. Now, this 30 days thing is weird, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever looked at this carefully, but this is weird that you would go to the king and say, "We've got this idea, 30-day trial, everybody worships you." And it's like, if King Darius is worthy of worship, he's worthy of worship beyond 30 days, and if he's not worthy of worship, this is really ridiculous. And so it's weird that Darius fell for this. I suppose the only explanation is his ego was bigger than his brain, and so we don't know, of course, why he fell for it necessarily, but the fact that they're only asking for a 30-day decree is evidence that they had confidence in the fact that Daniel would in a very short time, would disobey this order. It wouldn't take long. They knew this. And of course, the lions then would make a meal out of him. Look at verse 9. So King Darius put the decree in writing. So he's played for a fool, he signs the bill into law, and now Daniel finds himself in much the same circumstances as his three friends did in chapter 3, if you're familiar with that chapter. Now there is a great, I don't want to say too much here at this point, but there's a great effort underway, and you know this, in our own culture today, to privatize or even to abolish the expression of all Christian conviction. This is nothing new. This is the same thing, the same situation that Daniel, of course, is facing. Look now at verse 10. Look at how Daniel responds. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God, just as he had done before. I love this verse. Maybe more than I should, or maybe for all the wrong reasons. I'll admit it. But I love this verse. I mean, this guy has got nerve. As soon as he's made aware of the decree and the stated punishment for disobeying it, he disobeys it. He's like, he goes upstairs to his room, opens the window, gets on his knees, and disobeys it. Now, we know, you and I know how the story ends. But Daniel didn't know how the story was going to end. In his mind, choosing to pray, choosing to go to his knees, was signing his own death sentence. Let's not miss this here. Though he has faith in God, he has no guarantee that God is going to deliver him. He has every reason to believe that he's going to be fed to lions. This is incredible. The detail, just as he had done before, I think here is critical. Again, three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. This really is the key to understanding or fully appreciating Daniel's act of defiance of this royal decree. In other words, this is not merely an act of protest, which would be noteworthy enough. This is so much more. This was a life of protest. Don't miss this point. This is not some bravado that a lot of people, I mean, non-Christians, pagans, or even weak-kneed Christians can muster courage in some circumstances, maybe even in dire circumstances on occasion. But what we're seeing here is not merely an act of defiance, it's a life of defiance. It's a life of protest, or really where I want to put the emphasis this morning, it's a life of faithfulness. It is defiance. It is a protest. I'm not denying that. It is certainly that. But it's more than that. It is a life of faithfulness. That's what we're really seeing here. Daniel wasn't merely making a point. He was expressing his devotion to God just as he had done before. This is not so much a story about Daniel's actions, but it's a story about his character, or the metal of his soul, if you will. And I want to say significantly more about that here as I get to the end and share these lessons with you. But let's move on. Look at verse 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. No surprise to them, no surprise to us. Daniel was not like the hypocrites that Jesus chastised in Matthew chapter 6, who loved to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. That was not Daniel. Instead, he exhibited the prayer life that Jesus spoke of in that same chapter of Matthew, Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus said, "When you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." This is the prayer life of Daniel. It's not loud, it's not splashy, it's not arrogant, it's not self-serving. It is humble. But it's also not totally private. His prayer life was intended to be private. There's no question about that. But there were evil ears pressed against the wall under his window, as we read in this passage. And I think there's a lesson for us in this, and that is the world is watching us. The world is watching us. Even when it seems that they're not, they are. We don't need to flaunt our righteousness or our good deeds, but if we are faithful, we won't be able to hide them either. And there are two details here given regarding the content of Daniel's prayer, and I think both of them are telling. In verse 10, we read that Daniel gave thanks to his God. And here in verse 11, we read that he was asking God for help. It is easy enough to imagine being in Daniel's shoes and asking God for help. It's much more difficult, at least for me, to imagine being in Daniel's shoes and praising God. And yet he was doing this. Look at verse 12 and following. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. These are, of course, the satraps, the governors, and so forth. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree that you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." Again, these men will go to any lengths to destroy Daniel. Not only have they tricked King Darius into issuing this blasphemous decree, but now they are lying about Daniel, saying that he pays no attention to you, your majesty. That was the farthest thing from the truth. Daniel was loyal to the king. And Darius knew it. Look at verse 14. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." This is the third reference in this chapter to the law of the Medes and the Persians. And it is typical that those who disdain the law, the rule of law, are oftentimes quick to appeal to it when it serves their purposes, or to twist it, in this case, to serve their purposes. This should sound familiar to all of us in this room. It is hard, again, to miss the relevancy. We see the same behavior from politicians who enact unjust laws to protect their own personal interests or to target those who get in the way of their personal interests, namely you and I. Verse 16. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. King Darius is a very different kind of king than King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar ruled under an absolute monarchy. He was a dictator. He made the rules and then he broke them. He made the laws and then he broke them. But King Darius, not to be too kind here to King Darius, but he was ruling under a constitutional monarchy. He may have made the rules, but he was still bound by them and had some degree of respect for the law here. And of course, this respect for the law, to the degree that he had it, which he himself has established, has become a source of great personal pain for him. He obviously has some respect or affection or both for Daniel. He's lost a night of sleep over it. Okay, so he's anguished over this over the fact that he's been tricked into putting Daniel in this position. At the very least, Daniel is valuable to him, if not more than that. Verse 19, at the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. I mean, you sort of feel the urgency here in King Darius. He's like racing to the lion's den. Verse 20, when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" I love that question. Has he been able to do it? The Almighty, the Omnipotent, was he able to pull this off? Has your God been able to rescue? I mean, I like the question because, frankly, we've all asked it, haven't we, in some form or another? Maybe not out loud, but we've all asked it, will God deliver me? Could he deliver me? So Darius has had a sleepless night. He loves Daniel, or again, at least needs Daniel. Look at verse 21. Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. I think of James, chapter 5, verse 16, the prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective. Certainly see that here. And of course, this is a narrative. Not everyone who's thrown into a den of lions comes out of it the next morning. But Daniel did. God had mercy on Daniel. And Daniel then goes on to defend himself against the charge that was earlier brought by him in verse 13. He says, "I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." Daniel's still concerned about his reputation before the king. Look at verse 24 and following. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den. So there's a huge reversal here, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all of their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." And so Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And of course, Daniel's survival serves as a powerful evidence to King Darius that there is a law higher than man's law. Or more specifically, that there is a lawgiver higher than men. And he recognizes, at least on some level, that Daniel's God is the one true God. We can spend a lot of time, playing Dr. Phil here and trying to figure out the psychology of Darius. I'd hardly say he's a great advocate for Christianity or for theism necessarily. He seems, frankly, almost bipolar in this passage to me. But he's right in what he's saying here. This inspired, if you will, statement that he makes about Daniel's God is right. This kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will live forever. So we could say a lot about that. I mean, it's not just that there's been this reversal and that Daniel's enemies are thrown in the lion's den, but their families are thrown in the lion's den. And that raises a whole host of troubling questions that Wendell will attack next Sunday. But I want to draw attention to two thoughts here this morning, two lessons. The first one is this: faithful Christians are the best of citizens, or at least they are to be the best of citizens, even when living in Babylon. Now, we're not living in Babylon. Let's not exaggerate our situation in America. But we are headed that way. To have said that 5 or 10 years ago in most evangelical churches, maybe even today, but certainly 5 or 10 years ago, to make those kinds of comments in most evangelical churches 5 or 10 years ago, they would have thought you were wearing a tinfoil hat. They would have thought you were crazy. Even in some of the weakest evangelical churches today, people are recognizing the world is changing. Our world, our culture is rapidly changing. It is entirely conceivable that in another 24 months, another 36 months, 2 or 3 years, we're going to see serious persecution among churches, that at least those that are faithful to Christ. And so I think the relevancy here in this chapter is off the charts. Faithful Christians are to be the best of citizens even when living in Babylon. Jesus said this: "Give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar." He said, "Pray for your enemies." Paul said this in Romans 13, "Be subject to the governing authorities." Peter said this in 1 Peter chapter 2, "Show proper respect to everyone, love the family of believers, fear God, honor the king." We are to be the absolute best, most obedient of all the citizens in the United States of America. We're the best tippers. We keep our lawns mowed. We say, "Yes, ma'am," "No, sir." We open doors for the ladies. We don't double park our car. We return the extra $10, the $10 overage at Walmart. We found universities, hospitals, soup kitchens, rescue missions, adoption agencies, and on and on and on. We pray for our enemies. We are not perfect, but we're doggone good. And let's just brag about it this morning. Not about us, but about Christ. Yeah, the church is screwed up. which is still better than the government. It's still better than corporate America. It's still better than the United Nations. We're not perfect, but we're pretty good. And the world would be a much, much darker place if it were not for Christian influence. That said, sometimes, though, being the best of citizens down here requires us to exert our up there status. In other words, Philippians 3:20, Paul says that our citizenship is in heaven and we eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ. Daniel lived in Babylon, but he did not live for Babylon. He lived for the city with the foundations whose architect and builder is God, as we read in Hebrews 11. And this is a crucial distinction. Being the best of citizens in the United States of America or on a fallen planet requires that we become rebels, cage rattlers, whistleblowers, reformers. And this naturally brings us into conflict with the world. And this is why Jesus warned us, warned his disciples and you and I, of impending trouble, of hardship, of persecution, that we would be brought before rulers, that we would be hated, imprisoned, and even killed. This is also why Jesus promised great blessing if we remain faithful to the end. Being good citizens in a culture like ours that is becoming much more Babylonian in its nature does not mean that we go about our business quietly like good little boys and girls sitting on our hands and closing our mouths. Rather, it does require us to speak up, to speak out, and to speak often. It does require us to resist, to defy orders of the government. But we don't do it out of bravado. We don't do it out of pride. See how tough I am? See how bold I am? Instead, we do it in humility out of faithfulness. And I think that's all the difference in the world. If I someday would go to prison for my faith, and I hope I don't because I'm a real wimp, all right? But if I do, I don't want to be sitting in a prison cell somewhere and regretting the faithfulness that brought me there because I realized that the real thing that brought me there was my pride. In other words, we can go to jail for doing good things, but we do them with wrong motives. If I end up in prison someday, I want to know when I'm in there that I'm there because of my love for Jesus Christ, not because of my rebellious attitude toward the government. I think that's all the difference in the world. We are bound by higher laws. You know this in this church better than probably any evangelical church in this city, maybe in this state. So I don't want to belabor this. But our family tree is filled with men like Daniel and Peter and John and others, and women like Esther and many others who out of love for God, out of devotion for God, out of faithfulness to God, had no choice but to disobey the government. Had no choice but to, you know, ignore the king's decree, if you will. And I love this quote by Francis Schaeffer. He said, "If there is no final place for civil disobedience, then the government has been made autonomous, and as such it has been put in the place of the living God." Could you say that any more clearly? That's the choice that probably some of us are going to face someday. And I know it sounds alarmist, maybe even to a handful of people here this morning. It sounds sort of alarmist. I know there's this sort of this romantic notion about persecution. And, oh, yeah, that's what we need is a great dose of persecution. That may be true, but that's nothing to be romanticizing about. Persecution isn't always good for the church. Sometimes it destroys people because people are not strong. And this fairy tale idea that, well, if we love Jesus, then when the day comes, we're all going to stand. Yeah, there's a little more to it than that. It's about being faithful now, not just loving him in word, but in deed. It's really about preparing for that. And it's not about stockpiling food. And I mean, you can do that. That might be a good idea. But it's more than that. It's about what's inside of us. And that brings me to the second point. If we hope to stand then, 3 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, then we must kneel now. And I don't mean just pray. I certainly do mean that, but more than that. In other words, if we're going to stand in persecution or in great times of testing or trial in 3 years or 10 years or whatever, then we now need to be looking at our lives and asking, am I living in such a way that I'm strengthening that spiritual muscle in me to prepare myself for that time? Because most of the church is going to be caught horribly off guard by this. Daniel's blameless character had been nurtured over a lifetime. His courage was not conjured up as he was being thrown into the lion's den. It was the fruit of a series of smaller acts of faithfulness, the slow, steady nurturing of godly character over many years. Daniel's decision to serve God, regardless of the consequences, had long before, I am confident, had long before been firmly established in his heart and mind. And again, a powerful lesson here. We need to draw our line in the sand long before we find ourselves facing hungry lions. Pastors who fool themselves into thinking, well, I don't speak out against abortion or I don't speak out against homosexual behavior, but when the state tells me that I can't preach against the gospel, or I'm sorry, that I can't preach the gospel, then I'm going to take my stand. No, you won't. Because if you won't speak up for the little ones right now, you've already caved on the gospel. And if you won't love homosexuals enough to tell them the truth now, then you won't love them enough to tell them the truth when you're going to jail for it. Throughout this book, we have a good deal of detail about Daniel's character. And in this chapter, we have important detail regarding his actions. But nothing is said anywhere about his feelings or his fears. Certainly, he had fears. He was human. But a lifetime of devotion to God prepares one to walk calmly and confidently into trouble. Rosa Parks said this, "I have learned over the years that when one's mind is made up, this diminishes fear. Knowing what must be done does away with fear." I would only tweak that in a small way. I don't know that it does away with fear, but it does away with the temptation to cave into the fear. Daniel was free because like Rosa Parks, he had already settled the issue. This is inspiring to me. And you know, and I think about this stuff a lot, not because I'm trying to romanticize it in my mind, but because I'll be honest with you, I am terrified of what's coming. I'm terrified for me, selfishly speaking. I'm terrified for my family, my children, my grandchildren. I think dark days are ahead. Now I'm not Johnny Raincloud here this morning. I'm not trying to be gloomy here. But I really do think difficult, very difficult days are ahead. And I'm not confident that I'm going to stand when I need to. I know the kind of man that I want to be, but I also know the kind of man that I am right now. And it's not the same man. And maybe you would say that, maybe hopefully not. Maybe you're ready to go. Maybe you're further down the line than I am on this. But I'm honestly terrified of where things are going. But I also am confident that if I am faithful now, that God will give me the strength then, that he will grow me into the kind of man that I need to become. That book that I referenced about J. Gresham Machen, one of the best biographies I've read ever. In that book, he says this. He said, if we are really convinced, and again, J. Gresham Machen was just, the guy was immovable. He was a rock. Okay, and the world was against him. He said this, if we are really convinced of the truth of our message, then we can proclaim it before a world of enemies. Then the very difficulty of our task, the very scarcity of our allies becomes an inspiration. Then we can even rejoice that God did not place us in an easy age, but in a time of doubt and perplexity of battle. That is an inspiring thought in my mind. I hope it is for you. Privately and publicly declaring your desire to remain faithful to God in the face of great evil provides invaluable future accountability. I don't expect any of you to remember this, but many years ago when I was pastoring in this church, I made a declaration from the pulpit publicly, of course, and I did this again at Aletheia in Salina when I was pastoring there. And here was my declaration. Now, I don't have it written down somewhere. I wrote it down here, but it's from my memory, but it was something to this effect. I said this from this pulpit. If the day ever comes when we fail to stand for the preborn children from this pulpit, let it be known to our children and their children that we have abandoned Christ. Now, the reason I said that from this pulpit, or that pulpit, whatever pulpit we had then, the reason I said it was because I was afraid of my own will. I mean, I'm just being honest with you this morning. If I don't go on record that way, if I don't make bold declarations like that in front of brothers and sisters who love me, if I don't invite that accountability, I'm quite fearful of the fact that I may crumble when the day comes. Because I know the brittle clay I'm made out of. You know, this is why we make, when we get married, we make a wedding vow. And this is why we do it publicly. Because we acknowledge that it's not always going to be easy, and there are going to be mornings we wake up or nights that we go to bed that we want to bolt. We want to run from that spouse. We want to walk away. And so we make a vow and we do it publicly, recognizing that our wills are weak and that we need this kind of accountability. And it's not just me. You may be a lot more bold, a lot more mature spiritually than me, but you need it too. And that making that kind of a public declaration doesn't guarantee courage in that day, but it certainly does encourage it. I just want to maybe end by saying this. I don't mean to be gloomy this morning, and I hope I haven't come across that way to you. Because while I do fear, and while I have great concerns about what the future holds for the body of Christ, I'm also hopeful, because I really do believe that if we remain faithful, the opportunities that God gives us, that He will grant us, to share the gospel, to be a light in a very, very dark age, is going to be an incredible opportunity and a great blessing. And I guess I hope I live long enough to endure it and to be blessed by that. And I hope you do too. It's easy for us. I speak for myself anyway, and I think maybe for you as well. It is easy for us to just sort of get in the rut and just, you know, yeah, we read our Bibles, we come to church, we pray, and not be really paying attention to the signs of the times around us and to realize that this is not the America that it was 5 years ago. And if things continue to go the way that they are going, it won't look like this in another 5 years either. And so we're just wise. We're just smart to get ahead of it, or at least to keep up with it, and to be men and women of real faithfulness and real devotion to God, men and women who do pray, men and women who are in the Word, not out of duty, but out of desire. And I hope that's your heart this morning. Wendell?